Welcome to Thinking Deeply About Primary Education, the podcast that makes time and space to think about pedagogy, teaching and learning, professional development, anything of interest to time-poor but enthusiasm-rich primary teachers. Now, this week, I'm joined by Christopher Such and Dr. Robert Sharples for an exploration of English as an additional language and all that that entails. Now, I'm not going to spend much time introducing this episode because I know you will have listened to last week's and you'll be ready and raring to go. So without further ado, let's get straight back into it. Are there any common misconceptions you encounter in the profession about pupils who speak English as an additional language?
So it's important to note, because everything we've talked about, these misconceptions are coming from a good place. But in the absence of knowledge, you can get to a strange place quite quickly. So the most common and possibly the most damaging one you hear is asking parents to speak English at home. And you think, How could I do that? How could I parent my kids in another language I don't really speak? I mean, it's sort of ludicrous to imagine that I could. My daughter is five and she negotiates with me like she's trying to get hostages out of me. Like, the thought of being able to do that in another language, I couldn't. So why? Well, we know that children need a lot of exposure to language, and it makes intuitive sense that we should speak English as much as possible to maximize exposure. But there's other things to know as well. And in this particular case, and this is actually one of the reasons I've been coming back to that work on multilingual perspectives and translanguaging, is that whether or not languages are stored separately in the brain, they transfer really, really well. So the most effective thing that parents could do is to speak to children in their strongest language, or whatever language is right for their family. If parents speak different languages and they want to speak those different languages, the kids exposed to two languages at home plus one at school, do it. For everything that we've said, that's where the language is the most meaningful, the richest, and so on. And actually, as your language proficiency develops, and especially early primary, all children are developing their language proficiency. The grammatical system is largely in place before they start school, but their range of language, their ability to use it, the concepts that go with it are all developing. So you get that really, really great language model from the people who care for you at home and from your teachers at school. And that really helps develop that language capacity. And then, of course, as time goes by, you know, it transfers really well. Being able to do things with one language means you're able to do things with language in general. The same goes for literacy, actually. You know, you might see some measures of language development and literacy development coming a bit slower in bilingual children. But that's entirely logical. So, you know, first words you learn is from 0 to 1, infinite percentage increase. Next one from 1 to 2, from 2 to 4, 4 to 8, it's doubling each time. Fantastic. If that's split across two languages, I mean, you know, very simplifying things here, and you measure one of those languages, English, well, that kid's going to seem to have a smaller vocabulary. But there's no upper limit to what your vocabulary is. And very quickly, as they move through schooling and probably by this point into secondary, that upper limit is not that meaningful to us. So kids have such a big repertoire of language that we would say that they're just, you know, successfully bilingual. So using your strongest language at home and doing all the things that you do to develop children's language and literacy in whatever language is right for them is great. Now, you can make that more effective in the school if you can support both languages. And people would often ask, well, okay, if I'm going to encourage parents to speak to their children in their first language and read to them and you know, take them to the local museum, all these things that give you rich opportunities for talk. If I'm going to do all that in home language, how do I connect it to school? Because I don't speak those languages, so I can't really engage with that and I don't have any oversight of it. Something that secondary teachers incidentally often say is, I can't have children speaking other languages in school because there might be bullying. You know, you got to chuckle a little bit, right? Because I've never met a teacher who couldn't spot bullying at 100 paces. And if it's not happening in front of you, you wouldn't know anyway, which regardless of which language it is. So trust yourself, really. I think having children use other languages in the classroom, you might not know what they're saying, but I'm pretty confident you can spot if they're on task or not, or what the relationships are and so on. These are your skills. You can do this. So having some bilingual books in the class is really powerful, because that's just a big signal it's welcome. Asking children to read to you when that's the right age for that in other languages is incredibly powerful. You might not know what they're saying, but it's still really powerful because they're the ones doing the reading. Even if you can't give them the same level of feedback that you might do otherwise, it's still really powerful. If you think of a kind of a sequence of activities that you put together to make a lesson class, we often think that to develop really high levels of English, it's all got to be in English. And that you know, that's another misconception that's linked to home language. If we think about it, if we recognize that high level skills in both languages are going to support each other, you might be able to do a bit of scaffolding. And that is to say that if you're getting some of the children in your class to talk about something, and the classic example is from an early secondary, might be late primary, where they've got a sheet of paper with iron filings on top and a magnet underneath, and they're moving around. The kids are talking about this. And of course, the language is completely meaningless when it's written down in a book or a paper. Right? Oh no, what's that doing there? I'll shift that. Oh, look, that's doing that. It's so embedded in that context. Now, there's no reason why children can use all their languages to do that. I won't subject you to my bad French, but it's clear from the context what they're doing, what they're pointing to, what they're talking about. So from there, we might think about how they would begin to make notes on that, how they would begin to record it, how they'd speak back to the teacher or the class if they're asked to talk about what they found. So you can see that you might get, perhaps from being very free about use of different languages, you might encourage children to add some notes or have a practice where they can use both languages, or they could ask a classmate who shares the same first language if they have one, but to really try to get it into English. And when they write it up in their books, that they might have to do really in English. At an earlier stage, you might say, you can even, you know, give two colour pens if you want. Use your other colour if you need to write a word in, just to keep the writing going. And then we can go back over that and say, okay, so what? Well, so let's learn the English word for that, because you've got a gap there. You know you need one. Using children's different languages in the classroom when you don't speak that language is entirely feasible. But if you think about how the child is developing knowledge and skill through what you're doing across a period of time, whether that's half an hour a day, a week, a month, a year, you don't need everything to be in high quality English. You just need to get to high quality English. And the getting there, allowing them to use everything they know to support what they're doing, is going to be really, really powerful. So without kind of delving into too much of the details, common misconception is they need only English. And actually, at home, in class, there's loads of opportunities for them to use all their languages, and there's good reasons for doing it. I'd love to pause there, though, because I know when we were chatting before, you've come across loads of misconceptions as well. And I wondered if I could ask what you've come across.
I don't really know whether this is a misconception, but it's something that I've heard time and time again from teachers who have worked with quite a lot of pupils who are new to English. And it mirrors some of my experiences, which are that there's this idea that generally quite often pupils who are new to English fall into kind of one of two kind of camps. And on one side of things, you have pupils who are almost silent for a long time. So they're building up their language capabilities, but they don't have the confidence to use it. And, you know, that kind of mirrors what you were talking about earlier about the difference sometimes between that capability and confidence. And then there's a kind of second kind of pupil who from the very beginning are happy or happier to experiment with the new kind of nascent bits of English that they are developing. And whether it's a misconception or not, it tends to be around, for those pupils, from my experience, those pupils who are the kind of in the first camp, it tends to be around the 6 month mark where almost suddenly there's a, oh, wow. It feels like an explosion of language, and what it really is, or what it feels like at least, is more like an explosion of confidence. So they've been quietly building up this language capability, and then suddenly you've almost from nowhere, you feel like you've got sentences, etc. So I don't know whether this mirrors kind of conversations you've had with teachers, or whether it's completely silly to suggest that perhaps...
No, it's called the silent period. It's really well, really well attested, and you're absolutely on the money in everything you've said. So what's happening when kids are silent? They are not disengaged. They are not lost. They might be a bit lost, But they are really paying attention, they're attending to what's happening around them in their language. So if children arrive in a classroom, they don't speak the language, it is overwhelming at first. Part of what they're doing is just working out, you know, who's who, what's what, how do things work around here. But their brains are really attending to the language. And that's why it's so important, even in that silent period, to keep including them, even if you're not requiring a response. Oh yeah, that happened on your table, didn't it, Chris? Like, that just means that the language is still direct and they're still part of it. Underneath the bonnet, as it were, that pattern spotting machine in the brain, that is the brain, is just working really, really hard, trying to sort through triage, find patterns in the language. I guess you could talk about it as this sudden explosion where sentences come out. But another way to think about it is all this furious activity suddenly reaches escape velocity, if you like. And partly it's still with confidence. Not everyone is going to kind of launch at the same time. But those engines have been straining for quite a while, at least 6 weeks. So anything that happens in the first 6 weeks of a new pupil arriving in school, chalk it up to experience. There's not much point doing a lot of language testing in the first 6 weeks, because that most children just won't give you a true picture of their abilities so early on. And that's why we say, you know, place them high, sit them next to strong peers so they get that model. Make sure they've got some buddies. Do all the things that are going to just set in place. Don't worry too much about checking they've learned things. I mean, I'm not saying ignore them in the corner, but just recognize there's only so much that they can process at one given moment. There's a lot going on. And if you take from that 6 weeks up to 6 months or a year, a secure foundation means they're going to do amazingly across all that time. A wobbly foundation means that it's going to take so long for them to settle and get secure. So 6 weeks to 6 months is a realistic range. There is absolutely no need to worry about language delay or any kind of impairment or send in that time if a child isn't talking. It's absolutely normal. And if I'm honest, that's exactly how I would feel, to be honest. After that period, got some buddies and you're included in the classroom, you might look at ways to give them opportunities to speak. And that might be, you know, a think, pair, share, which might be quite simple with a classmate sitting next to them. It might be in a small group taken out by the TA to do some preparatory work. Everyone is so different. So often you'll find it's in those smaller settings when you'll begin to notice it. Sometimes it just comes out in a flood. There you go. Isn't life wonderful? But I think just knowing that really 6 months is a totally reasonable period of time. You would know, though, as you got sort of between 6 weeks and 6 months, whether that child is really isolated. And it's all the warning signs that you would look for with your safeguarding hat on. So if a child appears really withdrawn, I'd be concerned. If a child appears to be really isolated, I'd be concerned. But if a child is looking like their brain is working overtime and is, you know, they might not be talking very much to their classmates that they're sitting with because they are working at full tilt, just keeping up with things. So that one, absolutely, the silent period is really, really worth knowing about.
I guess the one of the misconception, or perhaps misconception, and again, in this one, like the last, might not be, that I've kind of come across are claims around, and often they seem quite outlandish, perhaps claims about the incredible long-term advantages that a pupil has academically if they speak, if they're bilingual or if they're multilingual. Now, it goes without saying that there are, you know, being able to speak multiple languages is itself, you know, a hugely valuable capability. But I wonder what the research perhaps suggests, and whether there is maybe a more nuanced picture about the values of it to, say, mathematics or learning history or whatever it might be.
Yeah, it's a really complex picture. And as far as academic stuff goes, can be pretty controversial. Academic Twitter is is not like teacher Twitter, right? So it's a lot more sedate, but still. Okay, so one of the main areas in which this bilingual advantage, as it's called, is described, is with something called executive function. And it's the idea that having two languages on the go at the brain, they're always being activated. So if you speak French and I show a picture of a pen, your brain's going to activate the word stylo and the word pen at the same time. And subconsciously, you will suppress one of those. So if you're speaking English, you'll sort of not let the French come up and the English will come up. And below the level of your consciousness, you are constantly exerting what's called an executive function to manage everything that's happening in the brain. Executive function is implicated in a wide range of really beneficial things. And so the thinking goes that because bilinguals are constantly exercising that executive function, it's going to have effects elsewhere where that is used. That's one aspect of it. There's lots of ways that we can also think about bilingualism. It's meant to have, for various other mechanisms, a protective effect against neurodegenerative diseases. It's meant to make your teeth whiter. It's meant to make you kind of a better cook. I don't know. The claims do get a bit outlandish, but fundamentally, there's a couple of ideas. One is social, that it makes you better able to understand the world and people in it. One is that things like executive function mean that you are better equipped for other, all kinds of other benefits. So this is not directly my area of research, and I will hereby annoy at least everyone. But for me, the evidence is not yet settled enough to use as the basis for professional judgment in teaching. And I think it's really important when we're academics talking with teachers that we talk about the strength of evidence as well as how interesting it is. There is some evidence that seems to be really strong, no, reasonably strong, and this is associated work of Thomas Back in Edinburgh and Dina Memegojevic in London, with what they call the healthy linguistic diet, and they've got a website if you Google that term, that learning languages all through life seems to have a protective effect in later life. As they think of it, eating a healthy diet is good for you in old age, a healthy linguistic diet similarly. And that may well be so. We don't know necessarily whether that's specific to a language or just because it's generally exercising your brain is good. Really controversial. Lots of really exciting research has been happening over the years. For schools, what does it tell us? Well, for starters, there's huge variation between individuals. So with the pupil sitting in front of you, I don't think there's much that you would change about what you do on the basis of that, except I'd say to have a generally positive view of bilingualism. So we know that bilingualism is a good thing. It might not live up to some of its stronger claims. And what we find in the research now is the claims are getting a bit attenuated. They're getting more specific. So some things will help in some areas, others will help in other areas, rather than these big broad claims that bilingualism is just amazing for everything. It's a bit unfair, generalizing a little. But it's not something that I think should change what you do day to day. There is some really good research though that looks at attainment at key stage one, key stage two, key stage three, key stage four. So I guess for people outside England, school leavers exams at 16 all the way down to early primary, that shows that consistently bilingual children with a high level of proficiency will outperform their monolingual peers. So we tend to use the five-stage model of proficiency that comes from the work of Hilary Hester before, but the DfE used it and the Bell Foundation use it in their assessment frameworks. It's become very established. So A is new to English and E is very, very fluent. So C is a kind of a good intermediate level. And what we see for primary is that children who arrive at stage A, new to English, or newish, because certainly if they've grown up in this country, they would have been exposed to English, even if they speak another language at home. But stage A, basically new to English, we would expect them to achieve solid stage C by the time they leave primary. A smaller percentage will achieve stage D. Some will not achieve stage C, and then that would be a worry. And then they'll go on and make the rest of the progress through early secondary, and by about year nine, you know, they should be really, really strong. Well, there's two things to note about that. Number one is that stages D and E are quite difficult to distinguish. It's easier to identify a child who's completely new to English than to distinguish between the very highest levels of proficiency. So because that kind of assessment is a specialist job, but it's not a specialism that is the same as teaching, we're not very good at distinguishing D and E. So I'd sort of take D plus as our most meaningful category. The other is that if we look, you know, at sort of bar charts that show on the vertical axis how well children do in an examination, and on the horizontal axis you've got A, B, C, D, E. I have to apologize to everyone. I had COVID a few weeks ago, and you can probably tell my voice isn't holding up the way it used to. So I keep chomping down my words. I'm sorry if that's irritating to listen to. If you look at those charts, then what you see is that at stage A, pupils tend to do very poorly in examinations. And you think, well, yeah, obviously. Try give me an exam in Chinese. I wouldn't do very well at all. Stage B, they do a bit better. Stage C, consistently. Now, we've looked at teacher-assessed and externally assessed assessments. They've looked at English, as well as a range of other subjects. And it's really consistent. So it's not like this applies in some places, but not others. It's a really consistent finding. At stage C, you're in spitting distance of the national average, often inside the margin of error. So at stage C, crucially, that's where we expect children to get to by the end of primary. You're able to access the curriculum pretty well. And then you can make the rest of the progress quite quickly. So that gives us a pretty good recommendation. Beyond the concepts of bilingual advantage, we know it's a pretty good thing. We know that children will actually do better, most likely on average, on assessments when they have a high level of proficiency. But there's a clear job here, and I think a realistic goal for primary teachers with children who are new to English: get them to that good intermediate level by the time they leave primary, and you know you've set them up, they can access the secondary curriculum pretty well, and they'll continue to make that progress. So what that does then is it pulls us down from bilingual advantage to, by and large, in secondary right now, we've got our strategies for what to do. Focus on security for new arrivals. Make sure we've got good language proficiency data. Think about how we might adapt that offer for different pupils. We know we've got to get them up to a certain stage. And if we do that, we've set them up well for what comes next. And if we can go further than that, fantastic. You know, you begin to get the shape of primary EAL in a way that you couldn't without that robust data.
Can I ask a really quick question off the back of that? Mm-hmm. You talk about, and mentioned a great deal earlier, the importance of recognising pupils' English proficiency, mm-hmm. And how that is a key determinant of, you know, their level of academic attainment at that point, etc. How formally or informally should a school go about this? Because presumably you can, you know, perhaps in certain circumstances find out from parents, or you can have conversations with the child and get a kind of a sense of where a pupil might be at. But that presumably only takes you so far. You mentioned kind of assessment materials from Bell Foundation. Are these things that are accessible to, say, a teacher or a SENCO, or are these things that should only be ever kind of used by a trained professional?
Very good question. Well, these are consequential decisions. So let's put it this way. Give us £1,000, Chris. I'm going to kind of glance at the front cover of the Financial Times, and then I'm going to decide where I'm going to invest your money for you. You know, we wouldn't make consequential decisions without really thinking through it. You need to know. So you can't, if you don't know where a pupil is starting from, how can you base good decisions professionally on it? You got to know. And without it, you're flying blind. So how can we find it out? You absolutely be systematic about it. So the Bell Foundation is my go-to recommendation. And if you just Google Bell Foundation EAL assessment framework, you have to register on their website, but you can download it for free. It was put together by a group of really well-regarded academics. So it is robust in what it does. And it's got a primary version and a secondary version. It comes with guidelines for using it. And essentially it gives this page, and it's got different skills. So speaking, listening, reading and viewing, writing, and a series of statements, 10 statements. So you can imagine the 10 columns, and each one has a little bit in it. Can they do this? And you just take a highlighter, and it gives you a best fit. And that will give you an overall picture. Now, it's got a couple of problems, is probably a bit strong, a couple of features to know about. So number one is people do often find it a bit slow to use. I think it gets quicker as you use it. But the feedback I get from people is it can be a bit weighty. And it often gives, you know, a bit more information than people are really prepared to use. And I recognize that, but I suspect the developers wanted to give really high quality data, and maybe, you know, that's overkill for where some schools are at the moment. But I think it's not a wrong decision. It's just a decision they had to make. Do we do something that's a bit more comprehensive or not? The other one is that it's teacher assessed. So I was talking to one nameless edtech platform who have got an online assessment you can use, and they were telling me, oh yeah, well of course it includes a function where the teacher can change the grade if necessary. And I nearly dropped my lukewarm coffee. What's the point of an assessment if you can just go in and change it then? So having an assessment that directly tests children's language will give you really good insight, but it basically means sticking a kid in front of an iPad for a while, and that's not always what we want to do. The assessment framework that Bell have designed is for teachers to observe children and to write down what they can do. So it's based on these can do statements, and that's got a kind of a long history in the language assessment field. So you get a bit of variation perhaps between teachers, but basically I think that is the best one. There's another one by NASSEA, NASSEA, based in the north of England. And then there's an American one called WIDA, WIDA. It's more commonly used in American schools and in a lot of international schools. It's similar in many ways to the Bell Foundation one. So I just start using it. It takes a bit of practice at first, I suppose, but it comes with guidance materials, and that's going to give you that really good data. It's not the only thing you can do. So a really good questionnaire on arrival. What languages are spoken at home? Who do you speak those languages to? And just know that in a lot of cultures, they're going to give you information that you or I might say isn't quite accurate, but we kind of need to check our own cultural assumptions a little bit. So we come from a country where for most people, we are taught good English in school. So a particular form of literacy and language use. There is one spoken and one written variety. There's some regional variation, but it's basically English in this country is English. Now, in a lot of parts of the world that are just fundamentally multilingual, that just doesn't quite make sense. So parents will often tell you the most prestigious language variety that they use. The Hindi, for example, it's a big kind of lingua franca. It's used all over parts of South Asia. And that's the language you would use if you're speaking to certain institutions or authority figures, perhaps. It's not the language the family would use at home, but it's the language that if they were asked, do you speak, they'd say, yes, we do. So when our school says, what language do you speak? And they say a language like Hindi. And actually then you find out later the kid doesn't speak Hindi at home. That's because we're just coming from very, very different places around the way languages are used in our communities. So a bit of exploring what languages do you use and with whom, for example, is going to give you that richer insight. Otherwise, you pair them up with a first language buddy with two languages they barely know, and you know, you can get into trouble. So that's just ways that you can get that bit more insight into what's happening. But just also, you know, keep adding to it. You'll learn so much with every child as you teach them. And if you can add that, that's great. The one caveat that I'd say is that that kind of data is only useful if it's used. And data that's meticulously collected, then stuck on a Google Drive or OneDrive and never seen again, isn't that helpful. So something we're doing at my university is we're working on a minute as a set of tools that will turn those assessment results, and we'll build an assessment for it, we'll turn them into teaching recommendations for that child. So we're building a system that can integrate all these various things that you know, and we're hoping to put together a simple web platform, for example, so that you can get to that usable information really, really quickly, and just cut out a lot of that variation. So, you know, watch this space, and we hope to come back at some point and tell you how that's going. But just recognizing that data that sits in the cupboard is useless. So using that to inform how you build out your practice is hard. And this is not a straightforward thing to do. It really is about kind of deepening your knowledge, working out what you're going to base your professional judgments on. I know we've talked about various things we've written, Chris. I've tried to set that up in a book, but also like I spend quite a lot of time just working with schools and particular groups of schools to just work through, okay, how do we put this in place? How does it work? So if someone wants to have a deeper conversation about how it might work in their school, they're very welcome just to get in touch, and I'd be happy to talk it through in a bit more of a specific way.
You've worked on projects specifically relating to migrant learners and refugees and school leadership. What would you want every teacher and school leader to know about how best to support these pupils?
If you've got your fundamentals straight for these pupils, then you're doing the right thing. And Chris mentioned that feeling of, and you've mentioned, Kieran, of not knowing quite what to do, and all the emotions that brings up. And I think particularly when we have children who have experienced trauma, we're human beings. That's often all we can see. These children are here because their parents wanted a better life for them. And we're not doing them justice if we don't offer that supportive stretching curriculum. So let's not be blinded by the lights. We talk about migrant and refugee peoples, I know I do, but they're not actually particularly meaningful terms because, you know, without dwelling on the many different types of legal status these children can have, they're children. So they're not getting deported anytime. And while they're here, they have a statutory right to an education, same as every child does. So I think for migrant or refugee children of primary age, then making sure you've got those fundamentals right is really, really important. As they get into secondary age, especially as they get closer to 16, 18, the legal stuff becomes more significant. And also you tend to get children who have migrated unaccompanied in mid-secondary. And of course, that's not something we see in primary age. So getting those fundamentals straight, making sure that they have just a welcoming environment where they're known, where they feel secure, where they are able to make some friends, where their teachers include them, where the teachers know that supporting all their languages is really, really important. That's the best start for everybody. And if you'll let me just talk about some of the things we've done outside schools. We've just done this project focusing on one city here in Bristol where I am, looking at actually the professionals who work with young migrants and refugees. And although I think a lot of these pupils were older than primary age, I think it applies really well. So we asked teachers, psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, immigration solicitors, foster carers, and a range of other people, a series of questions using something called a Delphi study, which is it's a multi-round questionnaire where you refine what people have said and send it back to them. And the aim is to find consensus. So where people disagree, you basically cut it out. And where they agree, you try and refine it. And there's some, we're writing that work up at the minute. We've got a short report that I can link to, all of 4 pages. The findings really surprised us. So the one thing that everybody agreed on was the thing that got in their way and made their lives harder, made it impossible to really support these children. And don't forget, this is from a huge range of backgrounds, not just education, was accommodation. So for these older learners, and of course for families and their younger children with them, nobody felt they could get traction until the kids were in a secure accommodation. And some of these children, their families, they've been moved every 28 days, whether that's to a different room in the same hotel or across the city or even across country. That instability in their lives made it very, very hard for any of these professionals to do their jobs. And that just comes back to, you know, how do we support all pupils? Well, just feeling safe and secure is the number one foundation, as with all children. We also ask questions about, you know, do you think that you're able to do a good job? Do you think that other people will be able to do a good job? When you try to get hold of someone to ask a question, do you think that they'll answer, be able to answer? And the responses were, you know, overwhelmingly negative to those questions. But then we asked, do you have confidence in the other people you're working with across these many professional sectors? And the answer was, yeah, absolutely. And we said, what's the one thing that would make your life better? And they said, an opportunity to meet each other and to learn from each other. So people didn't necessarily want, for working with migrant refugee peoples, they didn't necessarily want training in their own area. Education is a bit of an outlier here, to be honest. But immigration solicitors know how to process immigration cases, for example. So they didn't necessarily want training in their own area, but they wanted to understand how other people work with these kids so they could do their job better. And that was, I felt, really, really powerful. That the message from, you know, if we go through education and through that whole sector, things can be really, really challenging at the moment, especially. But there is such an enormous depth of mutual trust and goodwill. Even if you know you don't trust someone to pick up the phone, people recognize that that's a system problem, not an individual problem. And we had this launch event in September in Bristol, and you know, we'd booked for a certain number, and that number and a half turned up, and it was such a fantastic atmosphere to have all these people in a room together, and people really lingered, and you know, we did put on a bar, got to know each other a little. And so this perhaps is something that becomes really significant. It just goes back to everything we've said about those feelings of guilt and shame, about the need to give pupils a secure foundation before we build on it, and so on. That what we see in education is what we see across the sector for these pupils. And it just comes back to that fundamental, I guess, observation, belief, truism, that people who go into teaching are basically very, very good people, and who aren't always equipped with the knowledge and skills that they need to do the job they're trying to do. That's our failing as a sector. It's not anyone's failing as an individual. So then we think, right, well, okay, what do we need to do to change that? And my response to that is to say, well, I can't do your job. I don't think I could do it even if I tried, but I can do something that I think contributes to it. We need new evidence, and part of my job, the research side of my job, is to contribute to that. But we also need to understand how it all fits together and how it can inform a series of principles or kind of evidence-based positions that people can base their professional judgment on. Because those experiences you described, you didn't have that strong foundation to base your judgment on, and you get all kind of offline. I'll share some of the stories, but stuff people come up with just following a logical train to the middle of nowhere is really problematic. But if you've got that strong grounding in knowing how children acquire language, how it connects with their curriculum learning, what they need if they come from certain backgrounds, you very quickly, I think, get to a position where you can make really good judgments. And I would say, I mean, I've been doing this a while now, I meet very few people who believe they can make judgments as good as they can. So an awful lot of people say, I've got no idea. All I can tell you is, and then they tell you all this amazing stuff that they've known that they do. And actually, I think, you know, confidence might be a bit of an issue there as well. But just, you know, for migrant refugee pupils, foundations are the same. It's a lot more complex for some of their lives. You probably would do well working with people across the sector. So understanding, you know, are they going to their immigration solicitor or is their parents? Are they getting kind of mental health support from CAMHS, from the NHS? Do they have secure accommodation? That kind of thing is really good to know, because it helps you shape how you respond. But your educational response is going to be pretty much the same.
Quite often, you'll see in education, people, there's a thing where, you know, there's a, you scratch my back, I scratch yours. And so everyone says every book is absolutely wonderful, everything's incredible, yada, yada, yada. I can genuinely say, hand on heart, that your book, Teaching AAL Evidence-Based Strategies for the Classroom and School, is one of the best written, most accessible and most useful books I can imagine a teacher getting their hands on. Beyond your excellent book, are there any other resources that you would like direct teachers towards? I mean, you've already talked about the Bell Foundation, so it might be just that, but are there, beyond, say, your book, Bell Foundation. Is there anything else you would really, any other kind of websites, resources, whatever it might be, that you'd really want teachers and school leaders to know about?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, definitely buy my book. It's a terrific book. I hope one day to make sell enough copies to be able to afford one myself. So that book was written. I'll just speak about it a little bit because I think it was a bit of a labour of love. It's in three parts. The first part talks about how languages are acquired in a school setting. And the second part talks about how they're used in the curriculum. And the third part talks about how you can put that into practice. So you can see it very much reflects kind of my way of thinking about these things. I do hope that's useful. There's also, you know, I've got this personal bugbear about the kind of, and, you know, I do think the ones in your book, Chris, are rather good, but I've got this bugbear about people who I know in books where you have these tasks at the end of a chapter that say, you've read this, now reflect on how that works in your classroom. How are you supposed to do that? And I wrote a chapter years ago for one of these like big handbooks they use on teacher education programs. And I wrote it and the editors came back and go, oh, I've put the questions in for you. All right, then, you've read this. Now reflect on that. You can't do that. So the tasks, there's about 14 or 15, I think. The tasks I put in the book were things like, right, make a folder. These are the things should go in it. If you haven't got them, go and talk to your head. You need these things. Like, what's our policy on this? How do we do that? What do we know about this? One of them says, make an appointment with to see your line manager in 2 weeks' time. Right, this is how you spend that 2 weeks getting ready for it. And it sort of builds up from there. So it takes from someone who has just been appointed the EL coordinator. It's been maybe greatness has been thrust upon them. And they have no idea where to start, through to how you set up policies that work across groups of school or professional networks. So in terms of building up the skills, I did that because I didn't see anything between the kind of academic tomes in university libraries and top tips for Monday morning stuff you can get. I mean, some of this is very, very useful. So it was written to bridge that gap. There's another book edited by Hamish Chalmers in the Research Ed series. So it's a Research Ed guide to EAL, which is probably a little more leaning towards the scholarly side of things, but it's got contributions from practitioners as well as academics. And I think that's really helpful. It gives a kind of each chapter on. So my book is, you know, written by me. So it's my kind of my train of thought all the way through. The edited book, Research Ed Guide to EAL, I think is really helpful because it gives you a chapter on different topics. You get a different perspective. There's not a huge amount out there. There's some, I mean, Joe McIntyre's written a book on teaching refugee students, but we're beginning to move away from our core kind of EAL constituency there. So if I had to give people like a list of things to do, I love a checklist. I can't do anything. If it's not on my iCal or, you know, written in a checklist, it's just not happening. So obviously go and buy my book. Brilliant. Bring in a buddying scheme. If you're not sure, let's do the Hampshire MTAS Young Interpreter Scheme. Get a good assessment in place. So if you're not sure, download the Bill Foundation one. These are all free or remarkably low cost. Find some buddies because a lot of people will be very alone, actually. They'll be the EL coordinator, but don't really know anyone else. So lots of ways to do that. NALDIC, NALDIC, is the Subjects Association for EAL. They have an annual conference in November. Membership is like £40 a year. So again, for a professional body, it's not huge. Then you get the EAL journal three times a year, which is really good. But you also, I mean, they run a series of regional groups and special interest groups around the country. I think that's 10 or 15 now, which you don't have to be a member at all to go to. So even if you don't want to join your association, find out on their website where your nearest group is and join in. And they are really good. And ideally form a splinter group, go off, start another group. If someone splinters off and you, we kind of propagate this stuff around the country. Twitter used to be great for EAL. And there's a couple of groups that I'll dig out. I've sort of quit social media now. I think Elon Musk was the final straw for me. It's just stopped being so useful. So there's caveats with Twitter X. It used to be a really great place to share ideas. There's an EL bilingual Google group that's got about 700 people on it. And that's perfect when you've got questions about how much extra time does this child get in this exam or things like that, really technical stuff. Someone always knows it on there. So I'd start with those as a place. And thinking about it, you want to get a little bit of your bookshelf to work through at your pace. You want to get some day-to-day tools so that you can do what you want to do, you know, and have the tools to do it. And then you want to get in the network and just make some buddies, make some people to go through it with. And that probably would be my starting point for recommended resources.
Fantastic. I mean, and Chris is absolutely right. We actively don't take sponsorship or anything because we want our recommendations to mean something to people who are listening. So the Chris would speak so highly of the book. There's two things. I think it shows how much he cares about it, but also makes me want to read it very, very soon. And so I might have to bump it up my list. I mean, whenever Chris first floated the idea of this episode, I remember searching, and I think on possibly on your institution page, there your greatest hits or perhaps your whole bibliography are sort of listed. And so, you know, you can tell by the titles that you're working in it, you know, and even by your response earlier, some of your responses earlier on, you know, some really powerful research that really matters. And, you know, you're talking about having that purpose at the start of the episode. I think that's totally there. And it has been an absolute pleasure to spend the evening with you talking about this and even just scratching the surface.
Oh, it's been great fun. I'm a big fan of the podcast. It's just, you don't actually, you know, in my job, and I'm maybe in yours too, you don't actually get to spend a lot of time with people who do care in a way you do about some things that you do. And actually, you know, you build a community of people who think deeply about primary education. And as the parent of two primary age children, it's given me a lot of new things to think about as I kind of watch it from that angle, but also as an academic thinking, how can we make sure that bilingual children get the best shot? It's been a brilliant resource as I'm slowly working my way through the back catalogue.
And yeah, and thank you from me as well. It's just been such a pleasure to talk. You've whet the appetite with the idea of the resource that you are currently potentially putting together at your university relating to assessment and then follow-up actions. Love to have you back on the podcast if and when that comes into fruition, because I'm sure that would be incredibly useful to the profession. But yeah, thank you so much for your time. It really, it's really been fantastic to listen from you.
Thank you.
And everyone at home, until next time, thanks for listening.